When it comes to hypothetical thinking, psychologists have different opinions on how we reason. What is your theory of reasoning?
The idea we have to explain how people reason about hypothetical scenarios is that people are keeping in mind possibilities. And that contradicts an older version where an explanation for how people think was that they relied on inference rules, a bit like a mental logic, what logicians would have formulated in previous years. It was thought that people had access to that, almost like a language grammar, and so people could just reason by throwing away the content of what they were reasoning about and getting straight to the logical skeleton and then following through with various rules to make an inference. Our view is the opposite of that. Instead of emphasizing the language aspect of reasoning, we believe that people are relying on their imagination, their ability to image or think about possibilities in different ways, maybe through visual imagery or maybe through other kinds of mental representations that capture the meaning of what they're reasoning about, not necessarily the logical skeleton of it in very abstract terms, but the actual possibilities that correspond to the way the world would be if what you're saying to them was true. So people fall through the language to their interpretation of what it is that you've said to them by constructing these mental representations that are possibilities about how the world might be. And then they can manipulate those possibilities in various ways. They can eliminate some if they are contrary to their own knowledge or experience or what they believe to be true. Or they can flesh out those possibilities to include extra possibilities, again, corresponding to their knowledge or to how they believe the world is. So in our view, people don't dispense with the content of what they're reasoning about. Your knowledge, your opinions, your views of the world are very intrinsically bound up with how you're going to be able to reason about a situation. That's not to say that it's an illogical system. There's a set of rules there too for how you manipulate those possibilities. So we believe that people are rational in principle, but that sometimes they make mistakes in practice because of the difficulties of keeping all these alternative possibilities in our minds.
You believe that rational thought and imaginative thought may be based on the same kinds of cognitive processes that underpin thinking about possibilities. I just wonder, could you expand a little or briefly about that?
Yeah, one of the older views, I suppose, was that rationality and imagination might be polar opposites, and that if you were very imaginative, you weren't very logical, or if you were very logical, you weren't very imaginative. And one of the intriguing developments in the study of rationality over the last 10 or 20 years, largely attributable to Phil Johnson Laird in Princeton, has been the view that actually logical thought requires imagination, that in order to be able to be truly rational, to be able to reason very well, you have to be able to deploy your imagination, your ability to construct mental representations of the way the world might be, and then to see what follows from those imagined representations of the world. And so the next step that I was really interested in is whether the opposite is true, that it's also the case that to be really quite imaginative requires you to have a set of constraints that impose the boundaries on that imaginative process in such a way that it can be productive. And so in looking at, for example, one area of quite everyday imaginative thought, mundane everyday thoughts that people have about how the world might be different, one of the striking characteristics of it is that everybody tends to generate the same kinds of alternatives when they imagine how things could have turned out if only something else had happened. And it's clear that there are principles underlying the way that people are generating these alternatives to reality. And that's true not only in how people think about how the world could be different if they had done something differently or if something else had happened. It's also true when you ask people to, for example, imagine aliens on another planet. People tend to draw the same kinds of things. So there appear to be these regularities, or as Kahneman and Tversky said, these fault lines in our imagination, where everybody changes things the same way, imagines things the same way. And that of course relates to the knowledge that we have, the shared knowledge that we all have, and that guides, that essentially provides the structure for our imagination. So that made me think that the imagination follows these clear principles that are actually quite rational, and that you can characterize them by the same kinds of cognitive processes. And this is part of a larger view within psychology, sometimes referred to as creative cognition, that a lot of creativity isn't mysterious or magical or unavailable to scientific explanation, that creativity is arising out of exactly the same kinds of cognitive processes that logical thought or decision making or other kinds of thinking arise out of. It's just those building blocks are put together in different ways.
Just kind of on that, do you think that science suffers from its divide from the humanities? You know, do you think there's a relationship, a natural partnership between human and natural systems?
Yeah, very definitely. And I think psychology is very well placed there at the nexus between that, where to some extent we rely on the natural sciences methods, but we're very much studying a subject that has had huge input from the humanities, from fiction and so on. If you want to understand humans, where better to go than paintings or novels to find real insight into humanity. So I think psychology is very well placed right there in the middle between these two different huge monoliths of knowledge to be able to combine them, and we ignore either at our peril. I think a lot of the time the real value of interdisciplinary work is being able to bring together very different methods, very different approaches, and not reinvent the wheel, be able to gain from the insights in each of those disciplines.
I love hearing you say that, because I'm really interested in interdisciplinarity.
Yeah.
Some people focus more on facts than on imagining alternatives. Why does this happen?
Well, that's an intriguing question, because that's really gets to the heart of individual differences. And so a lot of the work that we've been carrying out looking at human imagination has been setting up situations where people can think most readily about the facts or think most readily about an alternative to reality. And one of the striking things that we found is that there do appear to be some individual differences there, that some people seem to be more prone to focus on the facts and other people are more prone to focus on the alternatives to reality. But it's at a very early stage of its development. It's a line of research that's difficult to pursue, to be able to get at it in a reliable, objective way, but it's certainly fascinating. What's easier to manipulate, and what we've done quite a bit, is that you can, in the way that you word things, in the way that you frame things, you can direct people towards the facts or direct them towards the alternative to reality. So to some extent you can see how people are driven to one or the other by the environment, but there also seems to be this element within people that gives them a preference towards one or the other. And I think that's a really fascinating area for future research.
Why do people imagine alternatives to some aspects of reality more readily than others? When do they think if only?
Yeah, well, thinking if only seems to be something that is provoked on us after unexpected or unusual kinds of outcomes, but largely after negative outcomes. We do it sometimes after very dramatic good outcomes. If, you know, if somebody wins a million unexpectedly, then you'll think, well, if I hadn't bought the lotto that week, I wouldn't have won a million. But largely it's after bad outcomes, after things that go wrong. And so one very strong view within this area is that people generate, if only, alternatives to reality because it's a learning mechanism. It's one of the key ways by which we unpick how certain antecedents led to certain outcomes so that we can avoid doing that again. So there's a view that we think about how situations could have turned out differently so that we can learn how to prevent bad things happening again. And sometimes then it becomes dysfunctional. If you're thinking about something really dramatic that's never going to happen again, say the death of a child, say people will sometimes think, if only I hadn't let him go out to play, if only I'd checked on him more during the night. And really that's not, it can become dysfunctional because it's not actually going to help you in the future. It's not something that's going to happen again, probably. So the part of the interest in looking at counterfactual thinking is to examine how to help people to overcome this natural, spontaneous tendency that we have to generate counterfactual alternatives. How to overcome that irresistible urge when it's no longer actually functionally helpful for you. But we all seem to be driven to do it. We seem to do it an awful lot in our everyday lives. And we as you mentioned, we tend to change the same sorts of things. So that's the really intriguing thing. Why do we focus on certain aspects of reality and undo them. And that seems to depend in part upon our mental representation of reality, what it is that we perceive to be there, how it is that we conceive of it in our minds. And these fault lines in reality, as Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky call them, tell us a lot about human knowledge, about the way that we construct reality within our own minds, because we all zoom in on things like things that fall within our own control, actions rather than inactions a lot of the time, at least from a short-term perspective. Sometimes over a long term we'll tend to focus on inactions. If only I had continued with my education, if only I'd learned the piano. People, when they get older, tend to focus on inactions, and people focus on first causes, on trying to identify what was the first thing that led to a whole series of actions, so that then if you undid that first cause, nothing else would have followed. And then there's other intriguing effects that tell you a little bit about how the mind works, like there's a recency effect where people in an independent series of events will tend to focus on the most recent thing. You see this in sports all the time, when the football player who loses the penalty has lost the whole match, even though there was a whole range of things that happened before that, but we focus on the most recent thing. And that may be telling us something about our working memory constraints, the limits of our attentional focus, and how we may be only able to keep a very small amount of information in mind at any one time. So these regularities of the imagination show us to some extent the structure of knowledge that we rely on, and tell us really that in constructing our alternatives to reality, we are constrained by our understanding of reality. And so that, of course, then leads to the question of how can you overcome those constraints? Are there ways that, and in particular with very imaginative people, what are they doing that get them beyond those knowledge constraints to be able to create things that none of us, the rest of us, would think of?
You wrote that the things people do not do far outnumber the things they do, and doing nothing leads to more instances of doing nothing, that some people may avoid taking action to avoid thinking about what might have been. Can you explain this a little?
There's a huge amount of research has been carried out on this omission bias, or a tendency that people have to regret actions a lot of the time rather than inactions. And as I said, there are some situations where people will regret inactions more often. But the interest in actions has been partly related to decision making, and whether we sometimes make decisions on the basis of our anticipated regret. If I do this, will I regret it in the future? And there's a whole set of factors that people seem to take into account when they're thinking about their actions, and whether or not, if you like, they'll change the status quo. So even when inaction will lead to a change, people seem to be much more inclined to regret their actions. And so the kind of counterfactual thoughts that people generate, their if-only thoughts, often focus on if only I hadn't done that, rather than if only I had done something. It may be the case also that our memories are implicated, that we just forget the reasons for inactions, for why we didn't do something, whereas we're more inclined to remember the reasons for why we did something.
Michel Serres is a French writer who studied both mathematics and philosophy. And he thinks that advancements in science, as much as in philosophy, lie in the inventing of concepts, and that this kind of invention requires a rapid intuition, which he says takes place in solitude and even in silence. What do you think happens at moments of insight?
That's a huge question, and there's one of the intriguing things that Kevin Dunbar has found is that when you study creativity, the creative process, it may actually be quite misleading to talk about a moment of insight. That in actual fact, that process may occur in a biology lab or in an artist's studio over quite a long period of time. And that's actually poses a real problem for psychologists attempting to understand creativity, because the process is not something that is just a moment. So understanding the moment of insight, some authors have suggested, doesn't really characterize human creativity on a grand scale in a very accurate way. But then there is another whole strand of research that specifically studies what's sometimes referred to as the aha phenomenon, where because there's no doubt, even in a prolonged period of study, there do appear to be moments where you do suddenly get a burst of insight into something. And what's intriguing, again, for us as psychologists, is that trying to tease apart what it is that we're conscious of and all of the work that's going on in our unconscious mind outside of our introspective access. And so psychologists dating a long time back to over 100 years have been interested in this aha moment of insight, because it seems to be the case that there's an incubation period that occurs beforehand where you put the problem out of your mind, where you don't attempt to solve it consciously, and yet work is going on. There's unconscious cognitive processing occurring, and that processing eventually delivers an answer or part of an answer into your conscious mind. And so you think you've just immediately intuitively gained access to something, but actually it may have been unconsciously being processed for quite some time before that.
No, I'm saying put it on the back burner for a while. Phil Johnson Laird said that intentionality is as much a central concept in human cognition as well as space, time and causality. Can you tell me more about this? Why is intentionality so central?
Well, George Miller and Phil Johnson Laird wrote a very interesting book in the 1970s where they proposed it was about language and perception. One of their interesting insights was that there are core concepts in mental life like causality, intentionality, space, time, that may help us to characterise the way people think, the way the mind works. And a lot of those different areas have had a considerable amount of attention from psychologists. There's a tremendous amount of work on causality and on spatial inference and on temporal inference to some extent. There hasn't been as much research carried out on intentional reasoning within psychology in recent years. There's a huge interest within philosophy about how people work out intentions and how intentions are distinguished from side effects or from being a means to an end and so on. From the point of view of psychology, and in particular from the point of view of hypothetical conditional inference, we know very little about how people reason about other people's intentions, reason about their beliefs or their goals, and how that affects the kinds of conclusions that they're willing to infer. So part of what we've been carrying out recently is research looking at different kinds of intentions and how people may make inferences from them when they're thinking hypothetically.